Bear's instantly on edge. He needs people to stop paying closer attention to his father, which only cranks up the risk that Pinch is exposed. Eva covers the mouthpiece and hollers.
Felix, what's our latest number on the Vinskys? 9 locked in,
comes the muffled response.
3 more likely, 6 maybes.
Eva returns to Pinch. We're confident of at least 18, and once word gets out about this show, serious collectors will be strangling their grandmothers to get their art in this catalogue. It'll be an adrenaline shot to the valuations. Anyone who misses out is dumb as shit. And needless to say, I would go weak at every pertinent joint to add any Blavinskys you have put aside. Eva, I'm not having anything to do with this. Already she screwed him once, pointing lawyers and the Mallard divorce to him for the provenance of that painting, washing her hands of the problem and pouring the dirty water over him. Does she think that when it serves her, people just forget?
Now hear me out, will ya?
She says, fake smile audible.
What we're hoping for, praying for, making goddamn animal sacrifices for, is an actual fresh contribution from the big bear himself.
Do you know how he feels about your gallery?
I know things weren't all smiles when he broke with us, but my papa was not himself towards the end. Point is, this is the moment to welcome Bear Bavinsky back to the Petros.
She adds, as if parenthetically,
he still lacks exclusive rep, right? I find that fucking scandalous.
Before I discuss any of this, I need to know what happened with Mallard. I thought we agreed. No, I don't think. You promised that the painting was going to stay in place. I told you I needed to keep that deal private. Now it's being sold somewhere.
Don't get your Calvins in a twist. Mallard's ex already sold it. And you know who bought it? Mallard himself. I talked him into it. Made it clear that your father's work was only going up. We did the deal anonymously on his side, so his dearly jilted wouldn't revenge milk him for a higher price.
Wait, Mallard buys the painting from me, with you taking a commission, then you sell him the exact same painting for a second commission?
So what, I'm a charity now?
And this show of yours, it'll include the Mallard picture?
That's looking like a no right now. He's still feeling a tad ripe about buying it through me twice.
But the other life stills you show, you're selling those?
Lordy no, most alones.
More charity work?
Oh, you are so funny. Look, your father is of an age. I see his market heating up, and I want my name attached.
He's of an age?
I just want Bear to know he has a home here. We haven't forgotten him. Never stop worshipping at the Bavinsky altar. I know your dad will want to join forces, and I'm gonna track him down by hook or by crook.
No, you won't, Pinch says, trying to stabilize his voice. I'll phone him. He makes the perfunctory call to Florida.
They're rats, that Petros clan, Bear says. I'll sue them if they do this.
On what grounds? You don't own those paintings. Anyway, don't worry. I'm blocking out all the stupid requests I can, but I wanted you to be warned. If anyone starts pestering you, just send them to me. Okay, Dad? Okay?
Why in the hell can't they leave me alone? It's no wonder I don't show my stuff to these savages. All they talk about is goddamn life stills that I did half a century ago.
And your recent stuff has moved on from there?
Where it moved is none of your concern, he answers coldly. Now, are you saying I should give this tramp something to put on a wall? Is that seriously what you're proposing?
The opposite. I'd say do not respond, even if Eva finds you. Hang up on her. Ignore her totally. Do not talk with her, and she'll fade away. Don't engage with any of these rats. Agreed?
They are goddamn rats,
Bear concurs, sniffing. Pinch knows that sniff, his father inflating with pride.
And they sure are taking notice, he adds stiffly. That kid yapping about me, what was it, Julius Schnuzel?
You mean Julian Schnabel, that was years back.
The guy couldn't stop praising me, I'm his biggest influence. What a load of horse manure.
Not that you listened.
I don't give a flying damn, he says, sniffing.
Dad, seriously, I think you should keep away from this. We're agreed on that, right?
1996. 54. When Bear flies to New York to oversee the hanging at the Petros Gallery, Pinch is expected as the artist's aide. This presumption, that he'd drop everything and rush across the Atlantic to serve the great man, causes Pinch to throttle a towel in his bathroom. Because he must go now. Partly it's for self-preservation, but he has another motive and tries not to dwell on it. It's the thought of his father, the man is well into his 80s now, doddering around there, tripping up, making mistakes. Pinch shakes his head. A long, loud effect of fathers. Out of pride, he sets a condition before he'll attend. Bear must invite all his children to the opening. Several have seen his paintings only in reproduction. The gallery reserves the painter and son a suite at a stylishly underlit midtown hotel. Its employees as sleek as the guests, everyone dressed like hitmen. Hitmen as imagined by Hollywood, lots of black Armani. Pinch winces apologetically to the check-in clerk when his father flirts with her.
"I'd give you my room number," Bear tells her, winking. "But I figure you noted it down already."
She laughs, for Bear is old enough now to find cute, and she perhaps noticed that his room is all expenses paid by a Soho gallery that also left a mammoth gift arrangement of flowers, fruit, cheeses. This guy must be somebody. In their suite, Bear dispatches the bellboy with a few bucks, closes the door, and slumps in an armchair, his forces spent at having acted as he once was, a front that he drops only around this child.
"What does that say?"
he asks, squinting at an itinerary left by the gallery.
"Read it out for me, would you, Charlie?"
Every item draws a sigh from Bear, who grumbles as if he's above such crap, though it's really because he's afraid of managing all this. Pinch promises to cancel everything that isn't mandatory.
"Yes, can you?"
Bear says, with alacrity.
"Please, do that, son."
Shortly, Bear has nodded off in that armchair and must be helped into one of the king-size beds for an afternoon nap. He is unable to get his shoes off, so Pinch unlaces them. Everybody gushes about how Bear never slows down. He's as driven today as when he was 50, because nobody is permitted to see this. Dressing that evening, Bear blusters around the suite, cursing this palaver. To be trotted before art phonies, having to endure their imbecilic questions. Pinch stands at the permalocked window, on the verge of confessing his forgery. What if Eva mentions the Mallard sale? She vowed not to, which means nothing. Pinch must prepare counterclaims. Am I walking into a public disaster? He stares down over West 46th Street, remembering his last visit to this city, roaming Central Park, trying to summon the guts to see Barrows. That was right after Natalie died, when Bear told him,
"Her pieces were never really first class."
Pinch's outrage stirs anew at this man who rants behind him, those liver-spotted hands gesticulating, his dry lips flapping about the anguish of art world attention. During the town car ride to Soho, neither of them speaks, each in his own funk. This will be the same gallery they visited together in 1965, though the neighborhood is much dolled up since then, yuppie pedestrians swinging shopping bags, gleaming storefronts, only a smattering of art spaces left. When the artist steps from the car, a welcoming committee awaits on the pavement. Eva.
"Oh, let me kiss you, glorious Bear."
A pretty publicist with orthodontically ideal whites. "You guys made it." And a bald gallery assistant in pink bow tie.
"I am literally exploding with excitement right now."
To one side stands Connor Thomas, now on staff at Art Forum, with ginger goatee and black eyeliner, long brown leather coat, and a red Manhattan Portage messenger bag that he clasps, dumbstruck before his idol. Everyone is gawking, not quite at Pinch, but near. It's intoxicating, people approaching Pinch with earnest whispers, knowing that he alone has the ear of the grizzled legend. Eva leads them all inside the gallery.
"You folks are all gussied up. Should have worn my dinner jacket,"
Bear exclaims, inviting only one response, which Eva deftly offers.
"Your only duty is to be Bear Bavinsky." She touches his arm. "Everything else, that's for us to worry about."
"Being Bear Bavinsky is a job I can just about handle."
Winking, he stuffs a bolt of tobacco into his pipe.
"Oh my God,"
the pink bow-tied assistant says, biting his lower lip.
"So sorry, there's no smoking in here." "Felix, I hope you're fucking kidding," Eva says. "Bear Bavinsky smokes wherever he likes. This is his house." "Oh my God, yes."
Next she calls over Connor, who wrote the catalogue text.
I'm so honored," he tells Bear, bowing. "I was thinking earlier how, for me, this is like meeting a figure from history."
"From history?" Eva retorts. "Bear is very much of this era."
"No, right, of course," Connor splutters, blushing. I mean, I can hardly believe it. Not that..."
"What I'm most jazzed about,"
Bear interrupts, heavy paw on Connor's shoulder,
"is meeting the writer who did that hell of a magazine piece. Point the kid out, would you?"
Bear scratches his beard, glancing mischievously around. Connor lowers his head.
You're too kind."
He looks up.
"I can't believe you read that. I'm so honored."
"You keep being honored," Bear quips. "Then you'll run out of honor altogether. You know where that can land a fella."
Everyone laughs to excess.
Word is you wrote the program notes, too, and a damn good job. Here's an idea. How about giving me a guided tour? What do you say?
Wait, what?
The bum's name is Bavinsky, am I right?
Bear says, sniffing. I would be... The toothy publicist interposes.
Do not say honored.
Humbled?
Connor ventures, and everyone laughs.
Can I be humbled?
As Bear is led off by the star-struck journalist, Pinch nearly rushes forward to chaperone his father, but this should be safe. The Mallard painting wasn't included, thankfully. Eva is still trying to woo the collector back, and Connor himself knows nothing dangerous. When the two return from the impromptu tour, Pinch asks his father how it went.
Tell you what, kiddo, a hell of a set of pictures they rustled up. Damn fine.
Bear never did invite his other children. When Pinch realizes, he is highly annoyed. But, guiltily, he is flattered too. He is the chosen child. He just hopes none of them hear about this event, which will convince them that he's trying to monopolize their father. Birdie has hinted that several siblings envy his access to Dad. The gallery fills fast with guests, a sweaty jazz quartet bopping hard, the saxophonist's neck engorged as he rips a solo, although it's barely audible over the jabbering. The crowd, white faces, asymmetrical haircuts, interesting glasses, includes a group of youths, art schoolers who scammed tickets and are making a rebel display of sitting on the floor, their hands around big glasses of free wine. One after another, renowned guests seek an audience with Bear, each of them raving not only about the paintings displayed tonight, but about his contribution, how his art had inspired them. Most of the Anconiums conclude with a version of, "What are you working on now? And won't you put any of it into the market? Please do."
"Satisfy your public, darling," Eva adds, handing Bear another flute of bubbly.
"Trying to bribe me with booze?" he says. "Because you can."
She stands on tiptoes, a short woman in silver stilettos, and gives him a peck on the lips.
"To buy you off, Bear, I'd try anything," she says, to whoops all around.
"They say Petros is an all-service gallery, right?"
quips a snarky Village Voice columnist, everyone cackling, clinking champagne flutes. Pinch stands a step apart, monitoring the scene. He takes out his pipe, feels for his zipper. Everything is going far better than he feared. After all those hours of dread and vigilance, he allows himself a break, leaning against a bare white wall, sipping iced Pinot Grigio, surveying the crowd, noting that more than a few people are looking at him, knowing who he is, a middle-aged son, like a shorter, uglier version of Bear, who works as a teacher in London. If he'd been born to another father, they would consider Pinch's achievements perfectly respectable, but relatives are judged relatively. A 60-ish man in blue Oxford button-down khaki trousers and Rockport boat shoes, one hand drumming a bum bag, the other gripping a glass of scotch, pushes through the crowd in the direction of Bear. An uneasy feeling suffuses Pinch. He delays lighting up, pockets his pipe, and hastens into the throng, cutting off the man's path.
"Hi there, can I help you?"
"You work here?"
"I'm assisting during the show, yes.
The name's Mallard Dwyer."
After an instant, Pinch makes himself stand tall, forces a smile, heart racing as he shifts subtly to block the route towards his father.
"What can I do for you?"
"Get out of my way, for a start."
"Is there something that you needed?"
"I need to speak with Bear Bavinsky. Can you help with that?"
"Definitely," Pinch says, chest tightening. "What may I say it's about?"
"Just get the man's attention, will you?"
"But your question?"
"How is that your concern?" "All right, fine. I bought a painting of his that shows some girl's hands. Now, I got this theory. Those hands are more than hands, because I know art has meanings that aren't what you see. And there's that saying, 'Let me give you a hand.' Is that what Bavinsky meant?"
Pinch nods double time, as if listening intently, sweat trickling down his brow. He wipes his upper lip, searching for any logical reason why Mallard might be disallowed from addressing the artist.
"I understand that the subconscious is important to artists," Mallard continues. "So is that what my painting is about? I want to hear it from the man himself. Pay good money for the thing. I got a right."
"All of Bear Bavinsky's portraits are painted from life, so I'm not sure the subconscious was central."
"Take my word, Bavinsky's highfalutin assistant. It's all the subconscious."
He downs his scotch, places the empty glass in Pinch's hand, and pushes past. Pinch launches himself before Dwyer again. "I'm sorry, it's not possible to just approach him. He doesn't like it. He's very shy."
Bear's laughter booms from across the room. Take your hand off me before I snap it.
I'm not touching you.
You just did. Out of my way.
Wait, hang on. Let me arrange something exclusive for you, okay? Privately with the artist, away from this crowd. I don't want anyone butting in when you're having your talk. I'll set it up and be back to you in a few minutes, okay? That's a promise, Mr. Dwyer.
Mallard, sucking his teeth, grunts as if to say, I guess this is how lefty New York homosexuals operate. He pushes back through the crowd to his trophy wife, who nibbles mousily around the crust of a tiny pizzetta. Dripping with sweat now, Pinch pushes towards Bear, overhearing his father regaling admirers with an account of when Audrey Hepburn visited his studio in Rome and prevailed on him to sell her a life still.
Dad?
Bear doesn't hear. Pinch tries again. His father talks all the louder. Finally, Pinch grabs his father's upper arm, causing Bear to turn livid. Pinch draws his father away from the others, saying dry-mouthed to Dad's hairy ear,
It's time to go, okay?
What's that?
Shouting.
The town car's still waiting outside. Let's make our exit, okay?
Like hell.
He shakes off his son and swivels towards where Mallard Dwyer lurks. The Nebraskan shoots a quizzical look at Pinch. Now? Pinch yanks his father back around, causing Bear to lose balance and clasp his son's windbreaker. Pinch grips Bear's elbow, holding firm when the man attempts to shake him off.
I came all the way across the ocean to help you, Dad.
Teeth gritted. Pinch swallows. And I'm telling you, it is time to leave. Now. Voice cracking.
Bear, now.
Enough of this, all right?
In desperation, he adds,
For God's sake, there must be a limit to how much fucking flattery you need.
Bear looks right at his son, and it's among the most disturbing sights of Pinch's life. Dad is frightened of me. Pinch drags his father towards the exit, gives a wave to Eva.
He's exhausted. Talk tomorrow.
Places Bear into the town car, jumps in afterwards, shoving his father along the leather seat. Back to the hotel, please. We're in a rush. Thanks. As the car pulls into traffic, Bear says,
Where do you get off talking to me like that?
It was time to go.
That's that. I decided it.
Done. Pinch looks out of the window.
Goddamn unbelievable.
Bear mumbles.
Never been...
His voice trails off. After a few minutes to cut the tension, Pinch points out where they stayed 3 decades earlier, recalling how he listened to a ball game in his room.
Nope. We watched the Yankees on the TV,
Bear says, more subdued. No, it was the Mets on the radio. You weren't there. You went back to the gallery, remember? Bear frowns, puzzled, as if maybe, perhaps maybe, all this talk of his events, unrecalled. I almost phoned Mom, but I couldn't figure out how to get an outside line, and I thought I'd get in trouble for calling overseas. Who knows if I even wanted to talk to her? Pinch pauses. Would be nice if there were a number to reach Natalie now. Tell her we're here together. He looks at his father. Bear says nothing. Up in the suite, the old man hobbles towards the bar fridge, takes out a lukewarm mini bottle of Moët et Chandon. Stiffly, he fetches 2 plastic cups, murmuring to himself. What's that about? Pinch asks, still rigid with tension.
A toast, I thought.
To what?
To our dear Natty,
Bear replies. Pinch cannot respond. He nods, raises his plastic cup, too moved to speak. 55. On his next visit to the cottage, Pinch takes out the one painting of his own hidden in the attic. During the drive here, he was so jittery, but that dissipated the moment he emerged from the rental car, breathed this bracing winter air, walked up the path, unlocked the cottage. Safe here. Still, it's too dangerous to keep this painting. He gives a last look, a woman's chin, and takes it outside to burn. That night he prepares duck confit, tasting directly from the pan, bubbles of fat spitting up his arms, gamey scent filling his nostrils, a fly buzzing somewhere in the dim kitchen. Each perception explodes inside him, then dissolves, experiences that are saved nowhere. He eats fast and lustily, then returns to the studio, painting until his focus blurs. There is no creaking forest outside, no loneliness, no time, only the bliss of action. On his last day, he destroys all his new efforts too, distracting himself while they burn by leafing through a book bought at the Strand while in New York. He intended to read this during his stay at the cottage, but he hasn't managed a single page, just the jacket copy, which says the essays were previously published in The Nation, The New York Review of Books, October
and the Times Literary Supplement. The author bio reads, Professor at Princeton University, P. J. Barrows, lives in New Jersey with her husband and two daughters. Why, Pinch wonders, must they detail her family status? How is that relevant? Is it to flaunt the author's perfected life? Why not print, stunning intellectual of renown, and she's got a winning spouse who probably runs marathons with his shirt off, an Ivy League lecturer himself, and did we mention their two adorable daughters, both cramming for exams, they'll surely ace? I'm being horrible, Pinch decides, whacking his thigh in punishment, which causes his dogs to run over and sniff the leg of his corduroys. She's achieved a far more substantial life than I, and justly so, Pinch thinks. Barrows had determination and rare talent. He wishes to boast of her to someone. What a muddled sensation, the success of one who didn't love you back. A metallic clang in the kitchen. He leaps, and the dogs bark. Only a frying pan that fell off the drying rack. Why am I so on edge? He survived the New York show. He looks to the ceiling, sighs, a shaky exhalation. Harold and Tony pant at him, tongues out. Your comments leave much to be desired, he tells them, stands by the window, darkness outside, the kitchen reflected, his eyes narrowing as if to draw a figure into focus. A tall young man in Toronto, with wildly colored scarves around his neck, babbling flamboyantly, leading Pinch through underground bars, a squirrel under his bed. Gosh, it was more than 20 years ago. On the night of Pinch's return to London, he travels directly to Utz, arriving after hours. His dogs bolt into Ching's office, where she is correcting homework. She emerges, a pen in each hand, like tiny ski poles. Do you eat dinner? Pretty much nightly. You want to visit the Sandwich Bar of Doom? I would love to, Ching, but I have my bodyguards to look after. He nods at Harold and Tony. I thought you are on holiday. I just popped in to do a little research. Actually, there's something I wanted to ask of you. I have to call someone, but don't want to do it myself. What I should say? I like that you don't even ask who, he responds, smiling. Okay, here's the situation. I'm trying to get someone's address, and I don't want him knowing it's me asking. Ever since thinking of Marsden, Pinch has wanted to find him again. Their sad meeting at the St. Charles Tavern when both were in such a desperate state was the wrong ending. Pinch even wonders if Marsden might concoct a clever way to help him escape this constant worry about the forged painting. At the least, Marsden could be a confidant. But Pinch is picturing the Marsden he once knew, not Marsden as he left him. Anyway, Pinch is too shy to just call and ask for help. He will apologize in a letter. He tells Ching, I was looking up things on Alta Vista on the staff computer, and it lets you read the white pages from different cities, including Toronto, where this friend of mine lives, he explains to Ching. The problem is, I want to write, and it shows only his phone number. She dials it and covers the mouthpiece, telling Pinch, I say flowers delivery. But don't give my name. While she talks, he hurries down the hall, shooing the dogs towards the staff room. He's so apprehensive these days, as if everything were ready to careen out of control. He pulls at his fingers, fighting back an image that keeps intruding, Mallard Dwyer slapping a scotch tumbler into Pinch's hand. Minutes later, Ching appears holding a scrap of paper with Marsden's address on the back. Ching, you're a genius! That night, he takes out Natalie's portable red Olivetti and types a long letter, expressing remorse about the end of their friendship. He revises, striking out passages. He reads it again, crossing out still more. Finally, he is left with the opening and closing salutations. Even there, he's unsure of the tone. He balls up all the attempts and tosses them down the living room carpet for the dogs, which give chase and chew. After classes at Utz, he visits the staff computer again and finds the phone number of a florist near Marsden's address. He'll bring to life Ching's ruse about that flower delivery. Pinch calls, ordering a modest arrangement to arrive anonymously. Soon a bouquet is presumably in Marsden's home, sowing mystery, which much amuses Pinch. To avoid detection, he waits a few weeks, then phones. The voice that responds, however, seems not to be Marsden's. The man has a soft, slow delivery. Marsden? Who is this? It's Charles Bavinsky. Sorry, I'm phoning for absolutely no good reason except that I keep thinking about you recently, and rustled up your number. It's been ages. How are you? Is this a good time? Sorry, Marsden, is it okay that I called? Charles, so lovely to hear your voice again. And yours, Marsden, he says, eyes welling up. And yours. Pinch coughs to disguise his cracking voice. He gives a hearty smoker's hack.
And where's my damn pipe?
He returns shortly and launches into loud chatter, asking for details about life in Toronto. These days, Marsden works part-time at the Art Gallery of Ontario, mostly doing photocopies for powerful people, which is fine, he explains. They know of his past problems and hide him despite all the gaps in his resume. He also volunteers at a Toronto charity for street kids, marching down the nastier alleyways with pamphlets on safe sex, shelters, needle exchanges. Isn't that dangerous?
You haven't seen me in a while. I'm pretty intimidating, Marsden says, in a voice utterly without threat.
For a spell, Marsden explains, he became obsessed with weights and bulked himself up with other means too. Lots of supplements and injections too.
Steroids? Really? Just to get strong?
To get beautiful, he replies. I've been off for ages, but my body doesn't go back to normal.
But you're okay now, in general.
Fine, yes. Given what I was up to, and when, it's a miracle that I'm still alive. The dreaded disease has spared me so far.
They talk and talk that evening.
Pinch called for help and advice, yet he discloses nothing about his predicament, only asks questions and listens. Marsden is as candid as ever, but not showy anymore. Disturbing details emerge, and he never twists the tale to burnish himself. He feels no shame about failure. He never had that defect. For a spell, he fell low indeed, even selling himself for a few years to pay for cocaine and amphetamines, prowling business hotels around King Street, downing a double amaretto in the lobby bar before 9 a.m., then heading to the lifts, upstairs for work. But that's the past, he says.
Hey, I was listening to the CBC the other day, and these critics were discussing your father. Apparently he's been discovered again.
So I hear.
I tell everyone at work how I was at U of T with Bear Bavinsky's son, he says. And the rest of your family, Charles, you still see that grandmother in Montreal?
Ruth died a few years ago, an unhappy end, I'm afraid, given what happened with my mother.
What happened with her?
Marsden asks, concerned.
Gosh, really has been ages since we spoke.
Pinch is never sure how to say this. Typically he says Natalie died of a long illness, but he tells the truth this time.
I remember answering sometimes when she called from London, Marsden says. I know you two were very close.
Pinch never considered it this way until hearing it. Natalie does accompany him more as years pass. When brushing his teeth at the medicine cabinet mirror, for instance, he sees her expression in his own. Or Natalie standing in his living room, looking at him. She shrugs.
Did she explain why? Marsden asks.
In movies, there's always a note, but hardly anyone leaves a note, it turns out. They'll even act. As Pinch speaks, her ceramics around the living room seem to light up.
I hate that you remember me avoiding her calls.
I remember you talking to her.
I feel guilty about what happened. Extremely. It's hardly ever somebody else. It's something inside the person who does it. I've met people like that.
Should that be worrying to me in another way? My grandfather attempted suicide, my mother did, he adds. With my wild social life, I could walk off stage without the curtain moving, though my afternoon tutorial schedule would be a disaster.
Don't joke about things like that.
I didn't mean it.
So lovely talking to you, Charles. I'm so pleased I called you, Mars. Hey, do you ever pass through London?
World travel isn't in the cards, I'm afraid, on my wages. It's month to month.
Well, if you find a pot of gold, you're welcome to crash on my couch.
I will definitely consider it, Marsden replies, meaning, I definitely can't.
Actually, know what? I've got school vacation in a couple of months, and I normally motor off to my dad's cottage in France. But what about this? What about you let me fly you here to London? You'd be helping me. I need your opinion on a few things.
My opinion isn't worth an intercontinental flight. It's yours for the price of a phone call.
No. This needs discussing in person, and honestly, he says, chuckling, aside from my dogs, I've actually got nothing to spend my savings on.
Except flowers.
How do you mean?
That wasn't you.
What wasn't me?
Oh, nothing. Someone's been stalking me with flower deliveries. I don't know anybody that nice around here. Probably some creepy old loser.
Not necessarily, Pinch responds, a trifle defensive.
I'm sure you have plenty of admirers.
But no dogs. Alas,
what kind are yours?
They're two sons that people mistake for dogs. Come meet them. It's a generous offer, but I couldn't accept.
As soon as they hang up, Pinch cancels his planned visit to France and resolves to buy his friend a plane ticket. 56. When Marsden emerges from Earl's Court Station, Pinch hesitates. His friend has the body of an ex-bouncer now, in a sweatshirt and jogging bottoms, face jowly, heavy pouches under his eyes. Pinch strides forward, touching Marsden's back in welcome. It's like clapping a stone column. They're formal at first, both concerned that 5 days might be excessive. As thanks for the plane ticket, Marsden insists on treating at every meal, which causes Pinch, mindful of his friend's poverty, to divert them to the cheapest eateries, claiming each as a favourite. It looks a bit greasy, but it's the best fish and chips in London. Marsden notes that Pinch sought his opinion on something and wanted to speak face to face. But Pinch delays. How can he say it aloud? I've destroyed a major work of art by my father. I've committed fraud. Everyone is going to find out. He'll come clean to Marsden, but not yet. This visit is too important. Mostly the two middle-aged men visit art museums, a decorated backdrop before which to restore their bond. Marsden wants to go to Sensation, an edgy show at the Royal Academy featuring contemporary British art, among which a frozen head made from the artist's blood, a dead shark mounted behind glass, and child mannequins with mouths like anuses and noses like penises. The boisterous young crowd is giddy and goaded. Pretty much all conceptual stuff, Marsden observes. Yes, I think that's right. It's not so much about making the pieces. The artist just needs the idea, and, as they point out, even the old masters had apprentices paint large bits of their pictures. Fine, but the old masters did some bits, Marsden notes, a glimmer of his former contrarian self. And they could have done the whole picture, time allowing. Well, all I know is that the worst British newspapers love denouncing this kind of art, which almost makes me like it. Marsden stands on the other side of the glass tank, appraising the pickled shark. Peeping into open jaw, he says, Is this good, enduring work, Charles, or is it taxidermy? I'm not sure enduring and good are the same thing, are they? As you can tell, I try not to have views on art anymore. Used to be all you had. You stopped drugs, I quit opinions. I still have a few, including that this show is making me dizzy, Marsden says. Window shopping at Fortnum and Mason's? Yes, a proper antidote. As they cross Piccadilly, Marsden mentions Barrows, that they're still in touch. Her husband is a lovely guy. They've got the cutest daughters. She's at Princeton, right? He says, masking his surge of feeling, inquiring as if only mildly curious. It's excellent when someone really worthy thrives, don't you think? Feels like vindication. She'd love to hear from you. Maybe. But more about you, Morris, he says, as the Fortnum and Mason's doorman admits them to a paradise of marzipan fruit and chocolate pyramids. Have you ended up happy? Much better than I was, which is sufficient for now. Marsden lists a few goals. One business idea is pet vacations for people who don't have pets. You'd pay to visit a farm and look after the animals. We'd assign each person a dog or cat or horse for the week. How does that sound? The idea lacks any of the bravura of the former Marsden, but this is a new person, and Pinch wishes to befriend him too, if only because they both knew that young man. Pet vacations. I'd like it. Upon departure, Marsden says, I still don't know what you wanted my opinion on. Well, maybe it was just trickery to get you here, Pinch twinkles, taking out his pipe. Funny to see you still puffing all the time. Pinch considers the object in his hand, frowns. I stole this from my father's tobacco box years ago when visiting him in Larchmont. He never noticed? I'm not even sure he's noticed that I smoke. Worry lurches inside him. Because his friend is leaving? Pinch extends his hand. Put it there. Instead, the thick-armed guest embraces his small-shouldered, pot-bellied host. Shyly, Pinch insists on his handshake, and it persists at length, each man wanting an extra minute to express that this trip was important. Finally, Marsden hoists his duffel bag, passes the tube turnstiles, disappears down an escalator. All the hurried pedestrians appear odd to Pinch, as if everyone in London had stilled these past 5 days, only to resume now. On the street, he holds a match over his pipe bowl, sucks down. After 2 drags, he removes the slobbery bit from his mouth, tongue buzzing, fingers yellowed. Crouching over a puddle, he taps out the tobacco, which hits the dirty water with a hiss. A smoke column rises, then is gone. Using all his force, he snaps the pipe in two and drops it in a rubbish bin. To a passerby, he says, "I just quit smoking." A week later, he sends a lump of money to Marsden. It was just sitting in his account, doing nothing. What are savings for, if not that? Weeks pass, and he hears nothing. His concern becomes annoyance, not even an acknowledgement. But a few weeks later, a 7-page letter arrives. Marsden explains that he was too touched, hadn't known what to do, how to thank such an act. "Don't thank me. It was a joy to do," Pinch writes back. "It comes with a sole condition. You're not allowed to pay it back. And a second sole condition. I need your help, Mars." 57. Worryingly, Bear has moved to the cottage and shows few signs of leaving. Normally he takes one trip there a year, a few weeks of summer break during which he cavorts and guzzles, rarely venturing into his studio. But he recently broke with his latest wife and appears to be settling at the French property this winter, talking of staying permanently, even resuming his art there. Any day he might discover what's missing. Pinch can do nothing but wait. "It's a disaster," he tells Marsden by phone, giving a variation on the truth, claiming that his crime was stealing an original Bear artwork from the cottage, then selling it to help his older sister. He feels too awful to confess that he drunkenly punched one of his father's paintings in spite, later burning it to hide the misdeed. He certainly isn't ready to admit to a forgery. That would mean confessing that he paints, a practice that feels too private, too fragile. Yet perhaps such qualms are immaterial now. Pinch might never again enter that studio. Without time in the mountains, standing before a blank canvas, trying to make something, what else do I have? Couldn't Dad go anywhere but there? "What makes it worse," he tells Marsden, "is there's no phone line at the cottage, so I can't reach Dad. I have no idea when or if he's leaving. Now and then I get him on one of his friends' mobiles, but for the most part I'm left in this permanent state of fear. I'm only praying he's still half-blind." "Half-blind?" "Dad left his glasses in Florida. The last time he spoke, he still hadn't replaced them, so he couldn't work. Not that blindness stops him driving on those mountain roads, which is insane. This whole thing is lunacy. I could see Dad freezing there. I know how to manage winter nights in that place, but am I supposed to quit my job and look after him now, his little assistant yet again? I'm not doing it. What's more, a leave of absence from Utz would be a risk. The chain is cutting costs, replacing experienced teachers with cuter, younger staff, which increases student enrollment. Among the latest hires is Francesca, who hadn't taught a single Italian class before starting at Utz. Initially, Pinch disdained the young botanist from Naples, who was immediately at his salary level. But she rose in his estimation by spurning the advances of Salvatore, then delicately telling Ching of her husband's serial betrayals. Ever since, Pinch has been most curious about Francesca. She's reserved, which makes him want to figure her out. In fantasies, he imagines taking her to the cottage, without Bear present. "No, you can't be on a string to your father," Marsden concurs. "But why not hire a local to watch him? It's hard to find anyone he'd accept, not least because Dad doesn't speak French. Didn't you say there are loads of foreigners around? How do I know they'll keep me posted? Bear would seduce them in minutes." "Okay, here's the plan," Marsden says, clearing his throat. Building to this. "I go." "To be Dad's housekeeper? No way, that's way below you." "My dear, you have no idea what's below me. And I want an adventure." "Are you certain, Mars?" Once assured about his friend's wishes, Pinch wires money for the travel and to buy a mobile phone so that Marsden may relay regular updates, and so the two friends can plot how to ease Bear out of there. Upon arrival in France, Marsden tests his new Nokia, calling the spymaster in London. After this, Pinch hears nothing for days and grows increasingly frantic. Each time he tries the French mobile, it's the same message, network service unavailable. Late at night, he panics about impending catastrophe and becomes exhausted and twitchy. Then, one evening, the display on his home phone lights up. He bursts off the couch, as do his woofing dogs, which leap about at his feet, causing Pinch to trip and fall to his knees. Wincing, he scrambles past the leaping Harold and Tony and grabs the phone. "Six rings before you pick up? No way to treat your old man," Bear says over a hissing connection. "You know what happened here?"
"What?"
Pinch responds with alarm. "I found me a new roommate, this big queer."
"Don't call him a queer," Pinch says, eyes closed with relief. "Everything's still okay."
"Care to talk with your queer? He's right beside me."
"Hey, I'm really sorry about that," Pinch tells Marsden. "My father is somewhat out of date.
Don't apologize. He recognizes an old homo when he sees one. We're having quite a time here. Your father is really something.
I know, all too well. I'm horrified that you never introduced us, Charles. I feel deprived. Oh, no, he's taking back the phone.
Bear yammers away, talking for two audiences, son and guest, mainly guest. When the old man returns the phone in order to go take a piss on the lawn, Marsden affirms that all truly is well. They've even established a routine. Each night, after Bear's guests stagger to their cars, the elderly artist, seemingly immune to booze, sets an appointment with Marsden for the following morning. If they agree on breakfast at 9, Bear is there at 7 a.m, looming over the leather couch where Marsden sleeps, using the fireplace as his pretext for the wake-up. Bear can't crouch to stack logs in the hearth because of his bad knees. Marsden arranges the wood, sparks a match, then is summoned to drink coffee and hear the old man's ribald tales. For a break each day, Marsden has assigned himself the task of hacking a walkway up the hillside. With the weather warming, he'd like Bear to get himself moving again, part of a strategy to eventually persuade the old man to leave this property. But to reach the hiking paths in the forest, one must clamber up a hillside, which is beyond Bear, hence Marsden's staircase. Honestly, Charles, I'm enjoying myself. Your father has insane stories. He's in what I call his anecdotage. You can say that, but Bear isn't exactly gaga. He needs his naps, yes, but he still spends a lot of time, on the job, so to speak. What's that mean? Diddling a lady down the road, and I know this for a fact. The Dutch woman? God, no, she's ancient history. They're feuding, actually. Yes, Dad specializes in feuds. You'll find half the locals won't say bonjour if you're linked to Monsieur Bavinsky. Who's the current lady friend? Lady friends, plural. A German working in Prague, and a French widow who keeps bringing yogurts. I'm telling you, Charles, it's a whorehouse up here. Keep asking myself how you became such a slouch in the love department with a father like him.
A question I've asked myself more than once, Mars.
Bear's current nemesis seems to be the Catalan people as a whole. He's deemed them loutish and pig-headed after clashing with a local couple who sneaked onto the property to collect wild morals. Marsden has been commanded to procure donkeys to guard the land and, ideally, to attack poachers. I pointed out there's no such thing as a guard donkey. Then the Catalan couple turned up again, and Bear marched out there himself. Remember, he's almost blind without his glasses, so I'm panicking that he's about to fall down the ravine. I run after, grabbing the back of his shirt while he's barking in broken French at these poor people with their mushroom baskets. They're talking about notre terroir or something, but your father can't understand. He's shouting, "Parlez français! Parlez français!" Meanwhile, the Catalan guy is going, "Monsieur, je vous parle en français." At which point you release the guard donkeys which ran down the ravine and bit the marauding Catalans? Both sides just kept screaming, which prompts an observation. Your father, who can't string a sentence together in French or Spanish or Catalan, gabs with everybody around here, while you, man of a million languages, have no interest in speaking to anyone. All I want is to talk to people. I just have to find the right ones. And how will I know what language they speak? I must be prepared. Both laugh, neither certain if that was a joke. What Pinch refrains from telling his friend is how trying life has become in London without the possibility of escapes to the cottage. Each day he feels smaller, but no sign of Dad noticing anything missing from the studio? That I know of? Nothing. Another week passes. Pinch imprisoned at his flat. His job. This isn't sustainable. When his home phone rings late at night, he rushes past his yapping dogs and picks up. It's Marsden, whispering, having stepped out of the cottage, ostensibly to get the firewood for tomorrow, but actually zigzagging around the dark lawn for a mobile phone signal. "I'm such an idiot," he whispers. "Why are you an idiot?" Pinch asks, heart pounding. "What happened?" It's the staircase and the hillside. What began as whimsy, Marsden explained, drifted into obsession. He's been spending hours out there, digging away, his palms a roadmap of dirt and blisters, nails cracked, joints creaking. Often, after toiling until dusk, he is scotched by a giant boulder, drops to the turf in frustration, hands on the soggy moss. As if repudiating a lifetime of half-finished pursuits, Marsden has decided he is going to complete this. Pinch interrupts. "But what happened? Is there a problem?" "I kept leaving Bear alone during the day. He got bored. I came home tonight and found him wearing glasses. One of his lady friends took him to Prague to buy replacements."
which means he'll be going back to the studio now, Pinch says, grimly.
Worse, he's already started an inventory of his paintings.
And he knows?
He's only just started, but I thought you should be warned. Charles, I'm so sorry. I messed this up.
You couldn't be expected to watch him all day long, Morris, and he doesn't know yet. Maybe he'll get distracted and move on to something else.
Or you could just tell him. Maybe you should.
Oh, he adds. Oh, shit.
What, Morris?
A muffled exchange follows.
Morris?
A deeper voice comes onto the line.
That you, kiddo?
Dad?
What's the secret chatter about?
We were just catching up.
I want to see you, son. Call in sick tomorrow.
Come there tomorrow? Are you serious?
Fly out. Get a rental car. Get up here.
Why, Dad? You have to tell me.
Who says there's a reason?
Could you put Marsden back on?
No answer.
Hello? Dad? Mars? Anyone there?
But the line is dead. 58. Pinch pulls over on a narrow French country road, delaying the last mile around the mountain, perhaps the final time he travels the route. He fumbles to open a bottle of water, takes a little sip, hardly able to swallow. Minutes later, he is there, his father walking from the cottage, Pinch hastening out of the car. Bear grips his shoulder, leans in.
Got a surprise for you.
When Marsden joins them, Bear leads everyone inside for a drink. Walking in his father's wake, Pinch stares hard at Marsden, mouthing,
"He knows?"
Eyes wide, Marsden shrugs. The two friends haven't spoken since that interrupted call. Bear has kept the mobile phone ever since. In the kitchen, he pours three hefty wallops of Calvados into pottery mugs, plonking these on the long table. The old man dominates the conversation, even when instructing Marsden to recount his Herculean labors on the hillside. Pitch sustains a polite front, toes curled. He needs to know why Bear rushed him here. Yet, he sits there, nodding, and would listen for days if it had delayed his expulsion from this place, which feels so much his, invaded by their voices. Realistically, he sees no way out. Even if Bear doesn't know yet, Pinch can't leave Marsden here indefinitely, spying on an old painter. Pinch envisages the revulsion on his father's face and looks down at the thighs of his corduroys. Bear keeps topping up everyone's drinks.
The fire roaring, the booze flowing. What else would a guy want? Save a few nice gals, hey? Though I can't speak for all of us in that department, am I right?
He shoves Marsden's thick shoulder, chuckling. Smiling back, Marsden unlaces his boot and massages his sore feet, casting a quick nod to Pinch. Maybe everything is okay.
I had this friend once, Bear says. Hell of a guy, tough as nails. Worked nights for the police down in Boca Raton. Interesting line of work. There's a real trick to it, he told me.
Trick to what?
Pinch asks, tensely.
You never, ever accuse the guy, Bear replies. He'll deny flat out, and then you're screwed, because he'll stick to that line out of pride, if nothing more. Now he's in a jam, and so are you. The way to do it, my buddy told me, is don't ask the guy if he's guilty. You ask why. Because anything a man does, it can be explained. Give him a chance to make sense of it all by his own logic.
They fall silent. The buzz of a fly. Bear lights his pipe, the cloud thickening around his head. He reaches for the Calvados, pours the dregs into Marsden's glass.
That painting, he says.
What painting?
Marsden responds.
The one you took. Tell us what you liked about it.
Marsden sits upright, astonished.
That I took?
What I can't figure, Bear continues, is how you got my studio keys. More impressive is that you whisked it away. Shows what a sucker I am without these specs on me.
He takes off his glasses, places them on the table.
Wouldn't hurt to know who you gave it to. I'm assuming you sold it already, and you got your reasons. Needed dough? Or just like shiny objects. Hey, nobody's hanging you from the ceiling. Let's just hear what happened.
Marsden says, I didn't take anything.
You heard what I said before, Bear insists. I'm looking to understand.
Dad, he didn't. Go through my stuff if you don't believe me, Marsden says.
Of course you didn't leave it in your stuff. What'd you take me for?
Dad, are you positive something's missing? Pinch asks. You know that for sure?
Bear's chair legs screech back. He stands, pointing at Marsden, a forefinger so arthritic as to resemble a sideways twig.
You had your chance. Call the cops, Charlie.
What are you talking about? No, Dad.
You can tell him in French, goddammit. Why do you think I brought you here? Get the police. I'll forget it was you who sent this rat my way.
Pinch stares into his sticky glass of liquor. He views the wood plank floor. Somehow he can't find the words for a confession. Dad, I have keys. That's all he can say. Then, that painting has been gone for ages. I needed help at the time. He will never mention Birdie. Pinch vows that to himself.
Gotta be kidding,
Bear says, wincing as if force-fed a battery.
You?
He rests his pipe on the kitchen table. Bear, Marsden interjects, you said things can be explained if you hear a person's reasons, and he had reasons.
Bear turns vehemently to Marsden, as if his son weren't here. Do you have any idea what that painting was? It was the guy's mother. His mother, Natalie, who took her own fucking life, who put a goddamn bag over her head.
I know what happened to her, Dad.
And he profits off that?
I didn't profit off it. This wasn't for money.
Not for money? Oh, sure.
Bear rears around, takes a step towards Pinch, jabbing his forefinger almost into his son's eyes, which are averted.
My whole life I've been making something of my time on this earth, and you'd wipe that out.
He shakes his head, bitterly disappointed, addressing Marsden.
He doesn't say a word to defend himself. Silence. Dead silence.
Suffering the outrage afresh, Bear bellows at Pinch.
How dare you?
Pinch's legs carry him down the driveway towards his car. His father bundles out of the cottage, Marsden alongside, a hand at Bear's elbow ready to intervene.
At the car door,
Bear clutches his son's lapel, digs in his pockets.
Give him over.
Pinch takes out a keyring, which Bear snatches away.
In my studio. Snooping around. Stealing from me. Who did you think you're dealing with? Who are you to me?
Marsden, pulling the old man back, says, come on, you're upset. But don't go to extremes. You two are close. Don't wreck that.
Close?
Bear says, shaking off the word. It's true, Marsden asserts.
It is. Not fucking close. He's just the one I picked. Of all my kids, I picked that one.
For good reason, Marsden says.
Sure, Bear concurs. Ever wonder why, Charlie? Look at me. You can't look at me.
I know why.
Let's hear it.
Same reason you chose my mother. Because nobody was as weak as us.
Untrue, Charlie, untrue. Not because you're weakest. Not for that. Reason I chose you, Charlie, is that you were the genuine number. You know what I mean?
Pinch shakes his head.
Natty knew it too, Bear continues. That Charlie's got something.
He mimes the act of drawing. Marsden asks what they're talking about, but it's father and son now. Nobody else present.
Know how many letters Natty wrote me? How talented you were? How you were really something else? Typical mother stuff, I figured. Then you bring that picture to Larchmont.
Which you barely looked at.
I saw it all right. When you and Carol were out, I go in the guest room, open your suitcase, almost the first day you were with us. I take out that rolled-up canvas, spread it out, and well, well, well,
he says, fixing on Pinch.
Natty wasn't wrong. You had plenty to learn, technically, but shit. You had something, Charlie. A style. Nobody can teach that. Gave me chills.
He points.
You had something, Charlie boy. And that is why I chose you.
Perplexed, Pinch grabs his sideburns. You told me I was terrible.
Let's be clear, son. I said you'd never be an artist. And take a gander at yourself. Was I wrong? You honestly think I'd be tagging along to gallery openings of my own kid?
Listen to me. Hear this. You work for me.
Get it? You always worked for me.
He claps his hand on Pinch's bicep, pinching hard, and you dare steal.
Get this. I win. You hear? I fucking win.
He taps his pipe onto the grass, a tiny heap of smoldering tobacco. Stamps it out.
Call the police, Marsden.
I'm not calling anyone.
Hell, you aren't.
I'm bigger than you. Forget it. Bear lunges at Marsden, who easily holds him back. The old man loses his balance, then pushes back, shouting as he walks up the grass. Off my property, both of you, now!
He's had too much to drink, Marsden tells Pinch. Get out of here for a while. This'll be okay. We'll fix this, just go for a while.
Pinch finds himself driving, heartbeat thudding in his ears, leaning into a bend in the road, sick drunk, out of sync, foot on the clutch, gearing down. At the nearest town, he jerks to a halt in a supermarket car park. On the steering wheel, his fingers tremble. He hears his own breaths, and Bear's voice, shards of that man lodged in him.
59. Bear, who left his glasses back in the cottage, is stumbling towards the woods, barely staying upright on the uneven turf.
Where are you going?
Marsden calls after him once Pinch has driven away.
Bear! All right, goddamn, please!
His shoe hits a stump, and he falls to his knees, swearing. Marsden hurries over, takes the old man's arm.
Get off of me!
Bear snaps.
In my studio! Him! Looking at my work!
It's not only Pinch who has lost control of this situation, Marsden realizes, because Bear cares about this son. Marsden refuses to let it end like this. His own father rejected him years before and remains trapped by pride, unable to find a way back.
Let's just take a breath here,
Marsden says, helping the man to his feet.
Charles made a huge mistake. I'm not disputing that. He shouldn't have gone in there or sold anything, but he regrets it, Bear. And he's your son.
Bear grunts, shakes his head, walking onward into the woods, each footfall unsteady.
Marsden hastens along, a step behind. This isn't safe, Bear. There's nobody to help you that way.
Bear trudges on, grasping for the rope handrail of Marsden's stairs, pulling himself up, one step at a time. Marsden stabilizes the old man until they reach the top, where the hiking paths begin. Bear takes the ascending trail, past a disused mine and mouths of caves. Beams of sunlight thrust through swaying leaves, sprinkling coins of light over the undergrowth.
Get, he says breathlessly, get the hell, the hell away from me! We need to go back to the cottage. I'm serious. Bear, it was only one painting. You don't have a clue. Just one painting. That's years of my life. Years!
Bear leans against a tree trunk, squinting, pained.
You don't have a clue. But my son, on the other hand, he of all people, he knows. For him to...
Marsden takes a half step forward, reaches for the old man's shoulder. He isn't shucked off.
Don't let this get out of control, Bear. You can't backtrack from a huge blow-up. You're saying it's my fault?
He shoves off Marsden's hand.
What has Charlie even amounted to? Nothing. He never will. What's he even do? Translating menus or something?
He's a language teacher,
Marsden says, suppressing his anger.
Oh, well, in that case, kid is really leaving his mark.
Marsden grabs Bear's wrist. The old man tries to pull free.
I've heard you telling every visitor here how your studio is some holy sanctum.
Marsden says.
You fucking liar. You haven't done a minute of work the whole time I've been here.
Bear struggles to get free, spittle bubbling on his lips, frothy dots hanging off his beard.
You.
Do you even know what art looks like anymore? That's why you don't let them sell your stuff, because you're a mediocrity, soon to be forgotten. You won? Really? Seriously?
I'll break you in two.
Bear's threat, its absurdity, deflates Marsden. Abruptly, he sees this scene, a half-blind painter, traduced by his dearest son, bullied. While Marsden was following after Bear, watching that he didn't fall, the old man was just trying to get away. He was afraid, his ranting the last resort of an injured animal. Marsden releases Bear's wrist. The old man falls onto his backside in the muck, ribs rising and falling, eyes hunted.
I'm sorry,
Marsden mutters, raising his palms in surrender. Bear sits there, shaking.
We need to cool down, both of us.
Marsden turns, exhaling slowly, walking a few steps to gaze over the path's edge, through trees that sink into the valley. The cottage must be straight below. He gives a tiny shake of his head, sighing in disappointment at himself. He hears a strange noise.
What?
He asks, spinning around.
What, bear?
The old man is on all fours, coughing, trying to lift his head.
The matter?
What is? Marsden drops to a crouch, a hand on Bear's back.